Welcome to the Emmy Louie Show. Today we are interviewing A.T. Man, and his nickname is Tad Man. A.T. Man is an author, painter, architect, and graphic designer. He has written, at least what I saw on his website, 14 books so far, and so we're here with Tad Man. Welcome, Tad.
Welcome. Nice to chat with you again.
Absolutely. Thank you for being on the show. So what have you been doing lately since we last talked a few months ago?
I've actually been getting a lot of things together that have taken quite a long time, and probably the main one is a book that I've been trying to get going for upwards of 15 years, and it's kind of changed form a few times, but right now it's a book called Sacred Landscape, and it's basically about sacred landscapes, and it's we've now have a publisher, we're pretty sure, and so therefore I'm going to be starting to write it in the very near future, and I'm really looking forward to it. It has a lot of ecological implications about, you know, the way we look at landscape and what actually constitutes sacred landscape. And questions like that. And it's going to be illustrated by a wonderful photographer friend of mine, Lynn Davis, who is a very famous landscape photographer and has taken amazing images in, I think at this point, 75 countries around the world. So it's a very exciting project.
Absolutely.
It actually ties in very much to what we're talking about in respect to feng shui and you know, there's a definite segue there for sure.
Absolutely.
I'm also about to write a report for tarot.com on my kind of astrological vision of feng shui. And I also look forward to that because it's a very different way of looking at feng shui. The principles, of course, are the same, but the mechanism is... how do you actually use feng shui instead of using an eightfold system? How would it work if you used one that had 12 sides,
mm-hmm. You know,
like the horoscope?
You have to, please excuse me one moment.
Michael, Amber, could you turn off the TV and go to bedroom, please? Turn it off right now.
I'm sorry, folks. Okay. Eightfold system. I'm 12-fold system versus an eightfold.
Yes. And what it would allow then, and what it does allow, because I've actually worked with it for years this way, it allows you to kind of superimpose a person's birth horoscope onto a feng shui wheel so that you can look around any room in your house or indeed look at your house as a whole and begin organizing it based around your own natal astrology. So it's a kind of transposition of Western and Eastern ideas, and I've used it quite a bit in my work in the past, and I find that it's incredibly valid and very interesting and a fresh approach that sometimes people can understand it a little more easily if they happen to know a little bit about Western astrology, just even the signs. And
You've written quite a few books on astrology. You've really taken off on the astrology part, haven't you?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, quite a few of my books are about astrology, and many others like Sacred Architecture. Although it isn't really about astrology, it certainly has a primary undercurrent in the book, which is all about heaven and earth and how orientation and location and things like that are significant. And, of course, that's exactly what feng shui is about as well. I think people are interested in feng shui because a lot of its issues, although they seem obscure to people who don't know much about it, once you begin actually working with it, I find a lot of the principles are just incredibly valuable for people to work with, and like most other things I've gotten involved with, I also have quite unique, if not heretical, ideas about it. So, So it's going to be an interesting process for me writing this this interpretation.
Heretical ideas, even right now.
Well, just in the sense that a lot of feng shui practitioners use a bit of astrology, but there aren't that many that are really practicing astrologers also. And I think once you do know about that astrological side, it actually becomes more and more dominant and really quite powerful. And another thing is that it's not static. You know, I often find that feng shui literature often seems as though something is really, this is the way it is. And yet, in fact, our lives are continually about change. And to my mind, the whole idea of feng shui, of flow and so on, is also about change. And once you start using astrological factors, it's changing all the time. So I choose to look at it as a much more fluid, movable, changeable, flexible kind of dynamic rather than, you know, something that's written in stone.
And I noticed on your website that you're on, you're going to be on CNN. Congratulations on that.
Yes.
Is that set?
Well, they're still making the program. They invited me down to New York, and I actually filmed a segment about a month ago or so looking at the presidential candidates for next year and election day astrologically. And it was actually very interesting to look at them in that way because we have quite accurate horoscopes for all of the major candidates. And it came up.
Can we take a peek on what you said or anything like that? I know.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting points was the man who interviewed me is Richard Roth, who's their UN correspondent, and I quite liked him. I got along very well with him. He asked some challenging questions, but I think the answers that I gave are not only valid, but also I think they're food for thought, and I think he thought the program would be kind of stimulating to people. But, for example, looking at the horoscopes of both Hillary and Barack Obama, they both have Scorpio rising, which is the sign on the eastern horizon in their horoscope. And since they also have very strong Leo qualities, which put planets very high up at the top of the horoscope, which in astrology means people are very highly directed, they're very focused, they make good leaders. But the interesting factor was on election day next year, Neptune is in the sign Aquarius, which is exactly at the bottom of their horoscopes. And what that shows often is something hidden or something illegal or a miscount, for example. If you remember the kind of vote count issues that attended the last two elections, it's interesting because either of the main Democratic candidates, and John Edwards as well, all have Neptune around the IC, which means that if a Democratic candidate does well, that there's going to be some question about the accuracy of the election. And he then asked me, well, did astrologers realize that Bush was going to win the last election? And I said, he didn't. So it's a very interesting, it's an interesting process, and none of the main Republican candidates have that same issue. So it's kind of intriguing in a way that a Democratic candidate is going to have vote-related issues and credibility issues with the polls, whereas the Republican candidates won't. And he asked me to kind of draw a conclusion about that, and I just said, you know, you draw the conclusion. So it's actually very interesting, and another part of the program that was kind of intriguing from his point of view was that he asked me basically how astrology works, and I tried to explain it on a very simple level, because during the next election, there will be an opposition between Saturn, the planet Saturn, and the planet Uranus, and this happens every 44 years. So if you go back from 2008, it's 1964. And I said to him, what was going on in 1964? There was a very unpopular war going on. There was a question around a president's credibility, that the public felt they'd been misled, and that There was a huge anti-war movement growing in the country. There was a lot of student unrest. There were economic problems. And I said, does that sound familiar? It's actually very much like what's happening right now.
I wanted to share this with you, Tad, and it's nothing, it's very, almost not idiotic, but it's kind of like the dummies version of politics. And I'm glad you're talking about this because it's going to be a year out before the elections. And I was asking people, I said, who do you think is going to win? Who's going to be president?
Right.
And someone said, Hillary. And I said, why? And this person said, because it's time for a woman president. I said, that's it?
Is that all there is?
Yes. I mean, is that it? You're not going to go and watch all these shows? And he goes, I might offend some people. And I said, well, what about a black president?
Right.
And the person says, no, it's just time for a woman president. I said, that's it? He goes, yes, that's it. I said, okay, I guess it'll save me some time and I don't have to watch all these shows or something.
Yeah.
And it says, it's just time. I said, okay.
Well, I mean, in a funny way, astrology is exactly about that. It is about time and about the nature of a particular moment in time can have a gigantic impact on who gets elected or who doesn't. And in that sense, I mean, another conversation I had with this quite interesting man was that, of course, if one knew these longer cycles, which astrology basically is a study of cycles, if you were aware of the implications of longer previous cycles, you'd have a much better sense of the fact that, you know, it's an echo of the Vietnam War. And people have said that after the fact, but not many people saw it before the fact. And I think that kind of resonance is extremely important, and I'm surprised politicians don't use it instead of poo-pooing it.
Use what?
Well, astrology.
Well, maybe they do. Maybe we're all closet astrologers.
Well, I mean, Reagan did, actually, and he was...
Well, he was the one that was vocal about it.
That's right.
What did you say? You said echo Vietnam War? Is that what you said?
Yes.
What is echo?
Yeah, because it was you know, exactly 40-odd years ago, which is a kind of Saturn-Uranus cycle that happens every 42 to 44 years. So right during the late 60s, there was a very similar kind of situation about an unpopular war that's happening right now and certainly will be a major issue in the election next year. And I'm just saying, if one had the foresight, like a president had the foresight, to really recognize these longer cycles, then, I mean, of course, the Bush administration has a completely different agenda about such things, but, you know, the fact that understanding those cycles can make a big difference and help one understand the whole flow of history.
Okay. Sounds good. We're here with Tad Mann, and I am Emmy Louie. We are listening to the Emmy Louie Show, and we will be back. Stay tuned. We're here with Tad Mann. I am Emmy Louie, and Tad's website is www.atmann.net, and that's ATMANN.NET. And so, Tad, so tell us about the astrology of our current president, President Bush.
Well, vis-a-vis the whole idea of cycles, his horoscope, of course, is interesting because he's born around Independence Day a couple of days later. And as a result, what that kind of synchronicity means in astrological terms is that a lot of the policies that he's enacted and a lot of the decisions he's made, I mean, this is a kind of no-brainer in some ways, but it's interesting that it resonates astrologically that a lot of the choices that he's made are going to really be with us for a long time. And that's, I think, extremely unfortunate because I don't agree with many of his policies at all. But, you know, whenever someone's horoscope is so close to the horoscope of a country, you can see that the impact that their policies have are very deeply rooted. They're, you know, extremely, extremely powerful for either good or bad, and have really quite a long-term impact on, you know, on the country as a whole. And I believe that Bush's presidency has had an effect like that, and I don't think it's a very positive one myself. You know, it's almost as though, you know, this individual, of course, the president does speak for the country itself, but it's as though this particular president, I think, has damaged our reputation quite profoundly. It's going to take not just a few years to turn around. But
the thing is that I know when after 9/11, and I was having strange conversations with a lot of people, and someone said, "Well, this might have to happen, and that it was destined."
Right.
And it's almost like this whole thing feels like it's like sometimes I wonder where our free will is and where our fate is.
Well, I wonder about that also, I have to admit.
In other words, it's almost like this whole thing fell in his lap. And I think that goes back into what the Notre Dame has said about that whole thing of like the Antichrist and all that. And I actually kind of forgot about that. Could you remind us about what was the whole prophecy? And even you hear it on mainstream.
Yeah, well, it's
and they
very...
say, well, you know, all of this stuff, there's a quickening, and then there's droughts and hurricanes. And then I thought to myself, you know, it's not because I'm doing this radio show. It's mainstream that people know that they're accepting that these prophecies. I forgot. Remind us of what it was. I called it.
Well, you know, one of the books I wrote a book in 1991 called Millennium Prophecies, and much of it was about Nostradamus and his prophecies for natural reasons, because once again, most of his prophecies were astrological in the way they function. And, you know, astrologers ever since then, for the last 500 years, have tried to, in a way, decode his method, you know, and try to understand, you know, exactly how he came up with his prophecies, because many of them seem unbelievably accurate. And when I say that, I mean, I've tested them myself, and I just find that whether you say that it's the language or, you know, the way in which they were said, it's very, very clever, because it does seem to apply to cycles of historical influences in a very interesting way. But he did talk about the impact of post-2000. In fact, one of the little subsections in my book was about prophecies of both Edgar Cayce and Nostradamus after the year 2000, where they predicted climatic upheaval. I mean, Nostradamus says this in such clear terms, that storms become more powerful, that there are continual disruptions that become more and more extreme. Now, the idea of anything environmental was, I mean, that kind of thinking didn't exist in Nostradamus' time. It's just so incredibly far ahead of its time that it kind of defies imagination. But the point is that I think his prophecies are actually very powerful about Antichrist. And what he means by that is really a kind of metaphor of someone who, you know, who, if anything, exaggerates kind of religious strife and conflict and uses that to create an atmosphere of terror. And I think this current administration has done exactly that. You know, really created an atmosphere where people are nervous and edgy and not really sure what's going to happen next. It's not the same in Europe, for sure. I've been there since 9/11 a number of times. But it's almost as though this is something that was kind of, I don't know whether it was fated beforehand, but, you know, you could easily say that it was something that seems sort of very relevant, and it's scary for that reason.
Yeah.
Nostradamus was quite profound, and I think a lot of Nostradamus' prophecies, they do resonate. They really do in an interesting way, and it really does make you think whether history is kind of fated in some way, and whether these kinds of cycles are intended to happen.
Oh, you
I mean,
know,
I look around and see the number of people who feel able to change things is seems smaller and smaller and smaller, and that also surprises me.
Yeah. I want to say it's kind of easy to say something about the administration, current administration, but I wanted to... I remember in... This is a little switch. When I'm doing my lectures and people say, well, since you're a feng shui consultant, why don't you feng shui the United States?
Right.
And I thought to myself, wow.
Well.
I thought, wow. And I was thinking, and then when you hear that from other countries, people say that we are the evil empire.
Right.
What goes through your mind? What goes through your mind?
I find that actually very interesting in many ways because I'm not sure whether you know this or not, but I actually lived out of the U.S. for almost 30 years. I lived in Europe for 29 years.
Where did you live?
I lived in England for most of that time, the first 18 or 19 or 20 years, and then I lived in Denmark for for most of the 90s.
So you were an expatriate.
I was an expatriate, and so when you live outside of the country, you hear things and you begin to look at the U.S. in a profoundly different way, and particularly because you realize how the media in the U.S., and I'm not accusing liberal media or anything, but just that the media in the U.S. is extremely biased. When you're here, you realize that you don't really hear a lot of news about what happens in the rest of the world. And as a result, America becomes more and more self-centered somehow, and I see that as being one of the most kind of striking things that I become aware of after having been away for a long time and coming back here.
Well, before you move into about being in England, is that news and history is a very, in and of itself, it's a very respectable profession. Because think about it. If you and I witness something, we witness an accident on the street, will what I say be exactly matching with what you say? Probably
not. Well, exactly. I mean,
probably not. And here, this is real time. Probably not, because I'm going to see it at a different angle. I'm going to have my own filters.
Right.
And that's just news right now. And think about history. In fact, I was reading this book, I think it was some Battle of Rome. And when Ovid wrote, or Livy wrote, the history of Rome, a lot of these writers, even like the Bible, is written 200 years after the incident. Think about it. It's like us writing about the Civil War.
We're
not even living at that time. So even if real time you have different viewpoints about what happens, can you imagine how things get filtered? I mean, we play telephone, a very simple child's game about processing information from one person to another, and by the time it gets to the 13th person, it's totally different.
Right, exactly.
At the same time, information is very fast with the Internet, and yet, at the same time, other news is totally distorted.
That's right. Yeah, it's like, you know, the way it seems in this country, the whole world is on terror alert. But once you get out of the U.S., no one really sees it that way. And you begin to realize, am I going crazy? Or or is it just something that really is because of the perception in this country?
Back to what were your perceptions when you lived there? What are some of the lessons that
you wish
other people in the United States would understand or try to understand?
Well, you look at America much more objectively when you live abroad because, you know, you're around a lot of people that have very different points of view. You know, things like both the countries I lived in, both the UK and Denmark, are what are called social democracies. And what this means is that, for example, health care is available to everyone, as it is for almost every European country. And coming back to the U.S., it's incredibly strange to realize that, you know, your health care constitutes a huge proportion of your income. And hospitals in those countries and medical care are not considered to be primarily money-making exercises, but rather they're there to keep people healthy and well. That's a profound difference in philosophy.
So why do you live here? I know some people say, well, if you're complaining about the United States, why don't you just move somewhere else?
I have lived abroad for a long time, and I had a very difficult situation happen when I was in Denmark in the late 90s, and it involved my Danish wife, who unfortunately had colon cancer, and I was really pretty shattered by the whole process, and I thought, you know, rather than living alone in Denmark in a country where I had some friends but not a huge huge ring of people, that I thought in a way it would be a good time for me to come back to the U.S. and just check things out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, immediately 9/11 happened, and that was a total shock, and the whole fiasco around the 2000 election. And I really begin to wonder, because, Americans, we're raised to be incredibly idealistic about this country. And that kind of idealism, it's like I begin to wonder, and I'm now actually becoming more and more convinced that it's actually quite misplaced, and that
yes, I know. It's maybe we have to stop watching Disney movies or something, because someone said that we should
America's
stop thinking
very aggressive in world affairs.
I'm sorry?
America's very aggressive in world affairs for its own interest, and yet we believe that American foreign policy is like completely idealistic in a way, you know, that our country is actually doing good and that everything we do is good. And you really begin to wonder about that, because that isn't the perception of the rest of the world of us. They see us as being a country that loves controlling others, and that economic reasons end up becoming dominant, and a whole range of things like that. That really does make you think, and I think that's why being abroad for a period of time, or even visiting, is incredibly valuable as an experience, because it, in a way, it forces you to kind of broaden your horizons. And,
does Mexico
and I think
count
that's a good
when
thing.
People say, have you been out of the country? And they say, oh, yeah, Mexico. Does that count?
What do you think?
Or Canada. Canada's very similar, I think. I mean, I've been there several times. And
you mean very similar to America?
Yes, because they're kind of North America, whereas
yeah.
If you go south, Mexico, it's different. And we are totally blessed, because I remember one time when I went abroad and I thought to myself, oh, my God, I started looking at the electrical panels and I started looking at the fire escape exits. I was thinking, I hope
sure.
this building holds up.
Right.
And we assume that buildings hold up in the United States. We assume that. You know, we walk into a hotel, it's going to hold up. I'm going to be able to get out of this building. That's not the case for some of these places around the country.
Around
the world.
Well, how about Minnesota recently?
What?
The bridge that collapsed. I mean,
yeah,
you know, a lot of the infrastructure in this country,
mm-hmm.
like roads and bridges and buildings, were actually built in the 40s and 50s and 60s in the post-war boom. And there's been a lot of talk about the fact that superstructure is kind of collapsing. And a lot of the money that should naturally be going to fixing the superstructure in this country is actually going to the war in Iraq.
Yeah, I know. You know, since you and I are trained architects, infrastructure is so important.
Yeah.
Infrastructure, in fact, infrastructure is similar to a tree. When you see a tree, it's not just the tree. It's the roots that hold up the tree. And
Absolutely.
That's the same thing with a building. So when you see a building, there's a whole bunch of foundation that's underneath the dirt, the soil, that you don't see that has to hold it up.
That's right.
And so infrastructure is about, I don't know what the costs are, I would say at least one-third of that entire system. Or, in fact, it's even more important because it's connected to the entire earth.
Absolutely.
And so when we see, like, in other words, we're so used to seeing things as things when what is unseen is probably even more important. And those are the things that people need to be aware of, is all the infrastructure.
I
so what
agree.
Is the definition of infrastructure?
That's
you wanna,
right.
You want to try and? define what an infrastructure is?
Well, I mean, you know, infrastructure simply means that, you know, it's one thing to build a bridge, but you also have to maintain it. And you also have to make sure that it stays in good working conditions. If you, the infrastructure in a country is what the whole system of people and financing that actually make sure that roads work and that, you know, things like the ecological issues. I mean, the rail system in this country is in a way being allowed to fall down and to break apart. And there's even a question around whether Amtrak will continue to exist. But I was listening to something just the other day that said that, you know, the ecological impact of driving is very similar to the impact of flying in an airplane, which, as you know, uses a gigantic amount of fuel. But the funny thing about it is that going by air actually is much, much more ecologically friendly than, I mean, excuse me, going by train is the most ecological way to travel. So in a funny way, we're going about it in the wrong direction, in that we should, like a lot of the European countries, they spend a lot of money making very sophisticated rail systems that allow you to get from one city to the next without driving. And that eliminates a whole range of kind of ecological issues. But, you know, in this country and in the major cities, with the exception of New York, there really isn't very active mass transit like that. And I think that's, you know, that kind of thing, I think, is what really needs to be looked at carefully. I mean, the Bush administration is proposing now that that a lot of these roads and highways, the interstate highways, that the federal government, you know, simply won't maintain them, and they're trying to make them into basically they want to create a kind of private world and privatize all of these state highways and the state highway system. I think that's catastrophic, but
well,
I think,
you know,
it's really...
Well, the whole privatization is rather cumbersome, especially if it's a road, right? If,
yeah.
In the very simplest part, I was thinking about what government does. Imagine if all our roads were privatized. Can you imagine that? Like, what if I owned, like, 20 foot of road, and then you owned 20 foot of road? We would have to stop every single time to pay a toll.
That's right, and that's what would happen.
It wouldn't make sense to pay if every... So on a very basic level, that's where privatization, capitalism, doesn't work.
That's right. Well, then the same thing would happen that has happened with hospitals. Instead of being, you know, hospitals weren't originally thought of as being, you know, profit-generating businesses. They were there because they provide an essential public service. And there's a big difference. I mean, then drugs can be purchased in large amounts at very good prices, whereas in this country, the kind of capitalistic idea means that everything is, you know, everything is competitive and everything is about making money. And if the ability of people to get around is inhibited in this way, then this country really has a big problem, because it's really central to the way the U.S. works.
Okay,
and getting
so
around
we are
is
here
a major
with
issue.
AT Man, Tad Man. I'm Emmy Louie, and we ended up talking about the United States. I am Emmy Louie, and we will be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie. You can visit my website at www.emyloue to access archives of the radio shows that I've been doing. I'm on my about 48th or 50th radio show for the last year, so it's very exciting to do these shows. We're back with Tad Mann, who's an astrologer and an architect. And so we are finished right now talking about politics, and we wanted to talk about sacred landscape. So what is your book about, Tad?
Well, the idea is that certain places exert a kind of magical power, and they, what I mean by sacred is something that goes beyond whether it's Buddhist or Christian or Jewish or Islamic, but rather to get to the core of the sacred itself, which is places that seem magical, that transport one, that make one think about heaven and earth and think about really essential issues in that respect. And you know, a lot of places like high mountains, for example, in early cultures were seen as being sacred simply because they were a source of wonder. And in fact, early people felt that and thought that in such places that it was where the gods ascended from heaven to earth, and also where ascended individuals like Moses, you know, getting the tables of the law on Mount Sinai. That what happens is actually that there's a whole concept called the sacred mountain then, which is that mountains themselves are somehow revered. And if you think about it, there are mountains all over the world that are revered like this, like Mount Fuji outside of Tokyo, or, you know, Mount Everest in the Himalayas, or Mount Kailash in northern India, and various mountains in the Alps and so on, and or Kilimanjaro in Africa. And the mountains have almost, these sacred mountains have like a mythology around them. And I think there's a similar mythology around trees. And I think that modern science has kind of gotten people into a place where they don't really revere the landscape and as a result just see it as a collection of trees, that it's inanimate, meaning that it doesn't really have a life of its own. And I think this book is profoundly ecological in its origin, because the point I'm trying to get across is that these mountains are in some ways alive. I mean, they represent changes that happened millions and millions of years ago. They're kind of icons in our mind. These concepts like the sacred mountain or the sacred tree is another one. You know, quite large trees have been worshipped since the beginning. If you think back of the Garden of Eden, the tree of good and evil, and things like the sacred tree or the tree of life, as it's called in Hebrew mysticism, you know, is a kind of sacred structure of the world. In Scandinavia, they worship something called the Yggdrasil, which is a kind of world ash tree. And so when you do something like have a tree in your garden or on your land, then I really think that these are very special, and that, you know, we should treat them in a very special way, almost as though they're sacred. Instead of the kind of modern view of things, which is it's all about commerce and about value and, you know, and a tendency to kind of see nature as not alive and not kind of active in that sense. And so this book is just exploring sacred places around the world and looking at why they're sacred and what it is about them that's so magical, and how, you know, we feel a need as humans to kind of travel quite long distances to go see such places. I'm actually going to Bali in exactly a month to teach for about 9 days, but after I teach, I'm taking a tour of people to a place called Borobudur, which is in Java, and it's one of the largest Buddhist temples in the world.
Why did you choose that place?
Well, because it's near Bali. It's about a one-hour plane ride away. But I chose it because it's a huge mandala. It's a huge mandala is like a meditation diagram. But it's a mandala that occupies, you know, 25 acres. It's huge. It has 1,000 Buddhas. And what's interesting about it is it's what's called in the East a stupa, meaning it's a building that has a square foundation and then a circular platform and then a series of square platforms that get successively smaller. And it looks actually like a mountain. It looks like a sacred mountain. And in fact, a lot of early temples did exactly that. They echoed the shape of the sacred mountain. And in the distance at Borobudur, there are two gigantic extinct volcanoes. And these volcanoes kind of echo the shape of Borobudur itself. There's actually a website called astrologyinbali.com, which runs the workshop that I'll be teaching on, and also is organizing this tour. But you can see pictures of Borobudur on the site, and it's extremely beautiful. And it's almost as though they pointed out sacred places in the landscape that were significant and have been significant for thousands and thousands of years.
Why did you choose Bali? Because I know that there is a lot of interest in Bali. And what is the reasoning of that?
Well, I just think that it's a culture where they kind of, once again, I'm attracted to it because it's a culture where they really worship nature. They still have festivals throughout the year that celebrate different times of the year, and not because they happen to be presidents' birthdays or, you know, revering Columbus, the discoverer of the country. But what they do is they actually are very much in tune with natural cycles. They're in tune with the yearly cycles. And I believe that's a primary factor in feng shui. And the feng shui report that I'm going to be writing is very much about that. It's really about not just actually creating a building or creating a space that has things in the right place, but how would this change throughout the year? And what would go on a month-to-month basis through the year?
I was thinking about that because I was reading a book about Alaska and how in Alaska in the winter months is practically, I think, dark.
Yeah.
And that Alaskans just live like other Americans do, and they have 9-to-5 jobs, and that that's a conflict because the natural thing to do is to go to bed, probably, and cuddle by the fire. Instead, they're working.
Right.
I wonder how, if we were to move into a more natural cycle, how our American landscape would look like. What would happen?
What would be
one of the first stages? I'm sure there's, it's translated in American workforce, it's called flex time.
Right.
But I wonder what the next steps are. Would you have any visions of that?
Well, that's a very important issue, I think. One thing you realize living in Denmark, which is quite a bit further north, where I am in Hudson, it's about 42 degrees north latitude. New York City is 40. San Francisco is less than 40 degrees north. L.A. is like 34 degrees north. Well, Copenhagen is 55 degrees north, so it's really closer to the North Pole than it is the equator. And the whole yearly cycle changes dramatically there simply because it gets dark this time of the year. In October, it gets dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it really leads to a very different kind of cycle. In fact, the Danes have a problem with depression because of that. It's like, it's dark so much that people begin to really miss the light, and there are even a whole series of afflictions that have to do with this kind of lack of daylight.
Yeah, the sad.
Yeah, SAD, exactly.
Yeah. I wonder, because I know that we have festivals here, like we have Christmas to celebrate darkness in a lot of ways, symbolically as well as literally.
Right.
And so I wonder what would happen. I mean, maybe we move more towards being Europeans, whether we like it or not.
Well, I think it is.
August off or something.
Yeah, it's an interesting point because people go inward at that time of the year over there. They really do go inside, and they structure their lives in a very different way because, you know, you don't really want to be outside particularly. And it's kind of fascinating to see it because, you know, it's just something you take for granted in this country. And yet it's something that has a profound difference. And that's why I think part of this book is about making people much more aware of these kind of natural cycles. I think brings us into tune with the natural world. And I think that in turn has very positive effects on our health and psychology.
I guess in that way, year-round school is that not in tune, or it depends?
No, I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that's the main problem. Year-round school isn't really the issue. It's just simply that we get out of touch with nature. I mean, quite literally, the definition of the word disease is about, or disaster come from the same root, which is a loss of contact with the stars.
Oh, disaster, loss of contact with the stars?
Yeah, because dis means separate from, and astro, A-S-T-R, A-S-T-E-R, or even disease is actually related to that whole root, A-S-T-R-O, which is about the stars.
So let's go back to your sacred, you want to still go back with your sacred landscape book? Tell me more about that. I know we kind of diverged, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No, it's. I find it profoundly interesting, all of that, simply because when people become more aware of of the land itself and begin to see it as being alive in earlier cultures, like in China. The health of the landscape was associated with the health of the people. And I would love to see that kind of connection reestablished again, because what that would bring is an ecological consciousness, but not doing it because it's politically correct, but doing it because it comes from the heart, and that one really wants, you know, the kind of natural world to survive and to, you know, retain the kind of incredible beauty that it possesses.
You know, I know growing up in Hawaii, there is the Pele, which is the, mm-hmm. I'm going to mess this up. She's the goddess. Or she's the goddess of the volcanoes.
Right.
And then in pictures, she is personified, a person, and it
yeah.
shows up as there's a volcano, and she's right under the volcano. Do we have anything equivalent to that in the United States, where we have certain mountain ranges as being entire spirits?
Well, there are, according to Native American
culture,
of course.
Okay.
You know, places like Mount Rainier and some of the natural landscape in the far west is considered sacred. And I've been researching it in the East Coast, believe it or not. There's a place in southern Ohio called Serpent Mound. You know, people talk about Columbus discovering America 500 years ago. But this place called Serpent Mound is a huge snake in the landscape, and it's probably a half a mile long. I've been there. And it's in southern Ohio, and it dates back 4,000 or 5,000 years. So there was a culture in this country that built huge earthworks. They're all over Ohio, western Pennsylvania, all over New England, on Cape Cod even.
So if you didn't write a book about this, I guess that might be your next book, right?
Well, it could easily be, and I'm certainly going to mention these things in Sacred Landscape, but it is interesting simply because these cultures kind of worship the natural world, and that was looked upon by later cultures like Christianity as being not such a good thing. But I think actually we could do worse than actually getting back into touch with nature and beginning to discover the magic of nature, getting back in touch with, you know, a much more intimate contact to the natural world, I think is just extremely healthy.
Well, not that I know anything about too much about the history of Christianity, but didn't the pagans as well as the Christian church kind of get into cahoots?
Yes, they did.
Do you know a lot about that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, right? And isn't that why?
Well, yes, that's exactly why. And that it didn't happen initially because most of the Christian churches in Europe were built on previously sacred sites, like one of the most famous is Chartres Cathedral, you know, in France outside of Paris, is a huge Roman Catholic cathedral, but it's built on the foundation of an Earth Mother temple underground, and it still exists in the basement of Chartres. There's a temple to the Black Virgin, so there's an element of more primitive Christianity that is... The term is really animistic. You know, animistic means that you personify some element of nature and worship it as a goddess or a god. And it's a kind of primal understanding or misunderstanding that early Christianity tried to wipe out. But in a way, they also appropriated a lot of those principles and integrated those principles into the worship of the saints or the Virgin Mary. So it's actually very interesting to go back to a way of looking at the natural world and nature as something that should be revered and should be respected. And, you know, it's actually straight out of the kind of new ecological movement. I think it's gaining strength, and I think it's coming back. And I think this book will help really clarify those issues quite profoundly.
Oh, that sounds exciting. So that book is called Sacred
Landscapes.
Landscapes.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
by... 18 Man, so his last name
yeah.
is Mann. That sounds neat because the unseen is so important.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it has a tremendous bearing on feng shui. I mean, I've discovered over the years some things that I think are really quite intriguing about even feng shui. It's like I used to think that actually that, you know, adjustments literally shifted the energy in a space, which of course they do, But what's also interesting is to realize how feng shui kind of symbolizes a person's willingness to change their approach to their own environment. And that I find that, it's almost as though the feng shui movement of furniture or adding other colors or signifying certain things with the color red, that a lot of those, their most powerful impact is not so much the impact they have on the space itself, but on your mind. You know, it in a sense, it forces you to change your attitude towards the space where you live. You look at it in a new way. And in that sense, there's a revived energy, and that the whole shift in awareness is what actually constitutes a major element of change.
I know. I know that I was just thinking about the Vietnam War Memorial in D.C.
Right.
And that one, that was a huge shift when that happened.
Yeah.
Because everything was above ground as far as the memorial is concerned, and this was profoundly underground.
Right.
And I'm just using that as an example on how just one experience of a space can profoundly influence your worldview.
That's exactly the point I'm making, that it's, you know, a lot of the earlier architecture, I wrote a book many years ago called Sacred Architecture, and it was, the gist of it was really that, you know, architecture used to be primarily symbolic in the sense that it kind of evoked particular mysteries or evoked the natural world in a way that was very, very powerful. And that, you know, in a way we've kind of lost the mystery somehow. And when you lose the mystery, you lose connection to the earth itself. And I think we basically suffer from that. And that's why I'm not saying we should become pagan again, but I'm certainly saying that I think it's extremely valuable for us to examine our relationship with the natural world and to really begin to appreciate how important it really is. And I don't know if you heard, but just this morning, Al Gore was given the Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize, for his environmental work. So mm-hmm. It's something that's changing. I think there's something changing in the consciousness that's actually making a huge shift.
I'm glad we're a part of it, Tad.
And I think feng shui and architecture are absolutely essential components of this major change. And
yeah,
I really look forward to this.
Absolutely. Because it's,
you know, it brings up skills that I know you have and I have as well. And it like kind of validates things that we've been doing for years and years.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm still doing the show, and I do what I do, because it has to manifest in a physical realm too. And
that's right. It's essential. It's essential that we, you know, it's of course interesting to make buildings or to do feng shui, but to change people's minds is really a major.
Yeah.
That'll really make a difference.
Absolutely. Thank you for being on the show, Tad.
You're very welcome, Emmy. We'll be in touch.
Yes, absolutely. I'm Emmy Lou.
Thank everyone out there for being present with us.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. I am Emmy Lou. This is the Emmy Lou Show, and namaste.